Welcome to Naked Word Radio and part the fifth of the Curious Chronicle of the Lost Hut, in which an adventure leads to a loss, but the loss leads to a discovery. Music dances its way across the landscape, and deities trample the shores. Sheep take me for a walk, and piglets wrestle in the night. Warrior, the sound of the bow. I am lost in loneliness. Above me, a truly empty sky, frozen in time, not a bird to be seen, not even as a distant dot. Beneath my feet, and stretching to the unseen shore, a swathe of sheep-short grass, edged by stone. Here in the far west of Ireland, fields are made by picking up the loose stones and making them into walls. No trees anywhere. Just a wild fuchsia hedge, taller than a man, motionless in the hot, still air, masking the old stone bothy that is my home. In the grassy banks that line the track running along the length of this tiny island grow eyebright, Glanrosh Gwaeloch, tiny white stars of flowers that clear the vision. Lady's bedstraw, Balar Knish, laid on a bed of bracken for sweet sleep. The yellow-horned poppy, Cachin nor Traw, that bleeds a cream-coloured opiate, and sea hollies, Quilan Traw, a fleshy, spine, salt-loving succulent that, according to dusty old herbals, can be used as a liver tonic. A bead of sweat trickles down my bare back, which is burned a leathery brown from the constant sun. I hear a truculent neighing and see Puck, a broad-backed white cob, just proud of 14 hands. I loop his working reins over my shoulder and open the gate into his field. A stubborn creature, he is, of course, in the farthest corner, overlooking the beach below. This is the only horse I have ever ridden. He has no saddle, and he has no need for iron shoes on the island. We make our way to the flatbed cart, and I hitch him up to it, ready to collect a load of seaweed, fresh from the shore. The hard physical work has its own particular pleasure, and I indulge myself in it, wearily recognizing, when it is done, that I have to face my emptiness again. I sprawl in an old wooden chair just outside the door of the bothy, looking west, out over the sea. The next land, way over the horizon, is America, and the sun is beginning to dip down to the line where sea meets sky. I open the last of the bottled beers left me by the Marquis, who owns this small holding, perched on the edge of the ocean, and raise it in a silent toast to she who has departed. It's very hard not to cast my mind back over the few months that we spent together, and my hopes that our relationship might have developed into something more permanent. I'm working as a chef in a popular French restaurant in the city of Bath. Housed in a Georgian stone building, the kitchen was on the first floor and the bar in the basement. There is much talk amongst the staff about a lady coming to run this bar and generally organise the front of house. On her first day, I go down to introduce myself, and I'm met by a strikingly handsome woman clad in red velvet. Broad-hipped, with an angular height, well-defined cheekbones and long auburn hair tied back, but not severely. A knee-length skirt topped by a smock-style top set her apart from any woman I had ever seen before. She served me with a large brandy and orange juice, a knowing smile on her face as she dutifully noted it in the staff drinks book. She fitted easily into the team and joined us in many late-night suppers that I would cook for all the staff at the end of service. Over the following weeks, we discovered a shared interest in a spiritual view of life. There was an esoteric bookshop down the hill, and we spent many hours in there meeting all kinds of folk, from the outlandish, a man who wore boots made to look like cloven hooves, to self-proclaimed druids and reincarnated King Arthurs. I began to see this exciting and inspiring woman as a Celtic figurehead, a high priestess. In long discussions, we explored the culture of the Celts and the ancient Egyptians. We went to parties and pubs and were an item for all to see. We took walks in the woods and lay naked in the moss, reveling in the wild nature we found in ourselves. She lived above a tattoo parlour in a quirky one-up, one-down building. The tattooist was not particularly enamoured of me, having his own designs on her. One night we returned to her home to find that he had changed the lock on the door, leaving a note addressed to the Wicked Witch of the West and her ginger Tom, suggesting that I depart as soon as possible, never to return. I lived in a caravan parked in an orchard on the hills outside Bath and overlooking the Severn Plain. On clear, bright days, I could see the Black Mountains. On days when the priestess came to stay with me, we would make plans for the near future and play music with my neighbours on the farm. Irish tunes and bluegrass were our preferred options, and out of this I developed a love for Celtic music. Both of us, inspired by the magic of Ireland and the openness of the people, decided to give up work and left our lives in England behind. We found accommodation in a variety of abandoned dwellings as we made our way along the south coast. One day, we discovered that our money had been stolen, and in the serendipitous surroundings of a magical country, we found a solution for survival. Newly discovered English self-exile friends told us about the Marquis. He was struggling with hepatitis, and unable to look after his livestock and vegetable garden. He was going to return to England to be with his family. He showed us his small holding, and a few days later left us in charge. We milked goats and wrestled with piglets in the middle of the night when their tethers got tangled up, hoed row upon row of beans, earthed up potatoes, and got bitten mercilessly by horseflies in the heat. He had a brown cow that took great delight in trying to crush me against the stone walls edging the lane. I lost myself in these daily routines, but couldn't fail to notice that this life was not for the High Priestess. What to me was idyllic was for her an unnecessary hardship, and I could feel her yearning to move on. She had planned for a long time to visit Egypt, and that desire overrode everything else. For many reasons, I hoped sincerely that her journey would not separate us. But in particular, I felt that we had shared a life together in some other time, and there were still many things for us to learn. Our lovemaking became tired and was no longer magical. I understood her wish to sail up the Nile, climb the pyramids, and immerse herself in the colours, the smells, the speech, the dry and dusty heat, and the lapis lazuli sky. Sure enough, the day came when I rowed her to the mainland and bid her goodbye as she caught the bus on the beginning of her journey east. For her, our time together was finished, but I could not abandon hope that we might see each other again, or even further our friendship into something greater, something deeper. Some weeks later, I sat in the wooden chair looking out over the ocean. I gazed at a postcard from her showing a picture of a dhow on the Nile and felt that I had truly lost faith in myself. An evening chill crept over me and I stepped inside the bothy to find my flare jeans, an icon of the 70s but woefully unsuitable for smallholding work. I could see no point in anything, could find no value in anything. I couldn't even cry. And then I saw my fiddle case, propped up in the corner and mostly hidden by a collection of coats. For a moment, time stood silent and still. How could I forget my Ermentrude, given to me by my stepfather when I was 20 years old? Suddenly, all the sounds of a small island came crowding in. The lonely mewing of seagulls and the squeaky toy chatter of oyster catchers patrolling the beach. Stonechats, remarkably shy, are hard to spot but easy to hear. Their call is like a clinking of pebbles. The gentle scolding of curlews with their long curved bills probed the sands below the tide line of shingle. A breeze off the sea picked up and began to play the weathered bamboo wind chimes hanging by the door as I bent down to pick up my fiddle. I put rosin on the bow, checked the tuning and began to play an Irish air. Its haunting melody floats out across the garden and I grow in confidence, breaking into a gentle jig that canters gracefully along. Already lighter in my own step, I move out of the bothy and perch on an upturned bucket by the door. The notes are beginning to flow now as I stroke and flick the bow across the strings. The air is dancing to the lilt of the rhythms, shimmering my vision, heat strokes rippling the unkempt grass. I fall into a series of notes that step into a graceful melody. I feel like I'm moving in time with it, climbing the phrases that build a picture, standing squarely in that image and then sadly facing its conclusion. Repeating the melody reinforces this storytelling, allowing each playing to emphasize an aspect or atmosphere in the overall drama. I put down the fiddle for a moment to take a mouthful of beer. I'm still very much in the land of music and decide to follow my inner ear and improvise. At moments like these, I feel free to wander through a world of notes with no particular thought of structure. Soon I am lost again in my mind, my only awareness being the expression of my mood in musical sentences of sound and paragraphs of harmonic phrases. In my music, I walk along an empty shoreline. Above me, a naked sky slowly fills with wisps of cirrus, whilst on the horizon, puffs of melancholic clouds gather, broody grey at the bottom, fading to hesitant white at their tops. The sea colour begins to lose its azure blue and shades towards a deep ocean moody green. The swell rises and begins to crash on the shingle. Plumes of spray climb the distant rocky edge of the bay. No longer alone, the weather walks with me, turns me towards the tussock-strewn dunes above the beach. A well-worn, bleached wooden hut faces the sea and welcomes me into its shelter as the first fat drops of rain dimple the sand. I sit on the hard bench, drawing my coat around me, and watch the gathering storm vent its fury. Flickers of lightning dance on the crests of well-travelled waves as the sky is bruised and battered into a cowering purple. I feel the steps of ancient deities quaking the ground and shredding the sky, and I treasure my shelter, however uncertain it may be. But in a breath, it's all over. The anger melts as the sky lightens, and the sun shines on the wading birds as they come out of their hiding in the dunes. A glimmer of rainbow arcs the horizon as the last of the squall clouds rains dry. Suddenly, I find myself back in the reality of the Bothy garden, sat on my upturned bucket, a curious robin begging for crumbs from my hand as the resonance fades from my fiddle. One morning, I go to see the two sheep that the Marquis keeps on his land. He's so worried that they will escape from the island that they are kept on running tethers. A length of rope is pegged into the ground at each end, and leather straps attach the sheep to this line. Eventually, they graze all the available grass, and I have to move the tethers. On this day, I need to move them to a new field, and having no collies to control them, I have to walk them like dogs on a lead. Of course, the sheep's intent is to run wild and free, and they are surprisingly strong, towing me at great and stumbling speed, up banks and down ditches and across the lane. Puck looks at me with mild amusement as we lurch past him and into the next field. The sheep decide to pause for a while, and I take this opportunity to hammer an iron peg into the ground to anchor one end of their line. Fortunately, they start grazing, and with some heaving and tugging, I manage to anchor the other end. In the afternoon of that sunny sheep-moving day, as I work my way down the rows of onions, bending their green tops to fatten the bulbs, I vow to never forget that my heartfelt awareness, my musical intuition, my aptitude for hearing and expressing music is a connection to the deeper me. If only I had remembered. And here ends part 5 of The Curious Chronicle of the Lost Heart.